Good morning and welcome to this March 1st, 2017 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on how to access our podcast later in the show. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. So happy to be doing what we always do, which is welcome authors onto our show. I'm excited this morning to welcome back Melissa Phoebos to the show this morning. She's joining me now. And in the second half, I'll chat with debut novelist Kate Dolan Leach about her novel Dead Letters. Melissa Phoebos is the author of the memoir Whip Smart. She was on the show with me in 2010 to talk about that. Her essays have appeared in Tin House, Granta, The Kenyon Review, The New York Times, and elsewhere. Portions of her latest collection of essay memoirs in Abandon Me have won prizes from Perry Schooner, Story Quarterly, the Center for Women Writers, elsewhere. She has twice earned notice on the 2016 Best American Essay Anthology. Abandon Me is the book. It's published by Bloomsbury, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Melissa, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be back. Hello. I remember our conversation from 2010 so well and so fondly.
7 years ago. What the heck?
I know. Can you believe that? I think we just stepped into a wormhole and have since popped out the other side of it.
Seriously. Well, while you were in the wormhole, you were very busy and productive. So good job. I wish I could step into a wormhole and come out with a fantastic book on the other end. That would be great.
Thank you.
So I'm going to let you take us into Abandon Me. I mean, maybe we should, I will mention that Whip Smart was also just an incredible memoir about your time as a dominatrix in New York City, just to preview that for our readers. And so Abandon Me in some ways to me felt almost, if possible, almost even braver, almost even more intimate, almost, you know, even closer to the bone. So I would love for you to take our listeners and readers into it, where it came from, how it came to be, all that stuff.
Sure. It's funny that you said that you used the word bone just then, because that is the word that keeps coming up as I'm talking about the book, that it felt both in the living and in the writing and now in the talking, I guess, very close to the bone. And when I finished Whip Smart, which was kind of a loud topic on the surface, you know, I thought afterwards, I was like, well, at least I'll never have to write anything that personal again. And I don't know that I've ever been quite so wrong about anything in my life. This book, Abandon Me, is, you know, I have a hard time sort of summing it up because it's about a lot of things on the surface, most primarily what it was like to grow up as the daughter of a sea captain. And then it also follows this very, very intense relationship that I had with an ex-girlfriend of mine and sort of twines together the story of my upbringing and selfhood and meeting my birth father for the first time with this very, very intense relationship and, you know, hopefully sort of highlights the ways that those experiences both have a causal relationship and also reflect one another in this kind of mirroring, the way that our adult choices reflect our childhood conditions. I don't know. That seems like a start, but it's also a collection of essays, and the subtitle on the book is Memoirs, because it seemed to sort of split the difference in a happy way between essays and a memoir, because the book was written, I wrote it in very distinct pieces with very distinct structures and voices and sort of focuses, but they're very inextricable. You know, my hope at least is that they all add up to one very tightly bound story.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is talking about this difference between memoirs and essays. And I've never really read anything quite like this. I don't know if you had a model in your mind when you structured it like this, but I thought it was really wonderful. And I was going to ask you, you know, when you conceived of the idea originally, kind of the point of entry for this, was it, you know, kind of the general topic of feeling abandoned? Or did you just kind of sit down and write a series of essays and say, okay, these are the themes that are kind of congealing, mm-hmm. and, you know, and they came together that way?
I mean, honestly, I wish I had a model. It would have been so much easier. And certainly I had writers and, you know, writers who've been influencing me my entire life, and more contemporary writers who were doing interesting things with form and bringing other texts into their work and remaining highly personal at the same time. But I really, you know, rather than sort of having a plan and executing it, or like looking at what I had and deciding something about it, it was much more like groping my way through a series of very dark caves. And, you know, I'm a very pragmatic writer. I have always been a big outliner and note taker, and everything I ever write tends to start with a list. And I, you know, I like to have a plan, and I have a pretty circumscribed process for writing essays particularly, and this book just like radically defied all of the methods I had used before. And I had this experience also that really sort of spoke to what the entire process would look like at the very beginning. And I always think of titles at the end. When I've finished writing something, it feels like the final sort of turn or the last piece of the puzzle, you know? And with this book, it was the exact opposite. I was in the midst of this extremely intense, harrowing, certainly life-changing experience, and I just had this sort of, this like bulb popped off in my mind, and I thought, abandon me. I'm going to write a book about this, and it's going to be called Abandon Me. And I didn't know anything else, and I wrote that title down on an index card, and I pinned it to my wall, and it stayed there for a few years. I even relocated it to my next apartment, and it was quite some time before I knew anything else about the book. And, you know, I wrote a few of the essays in it before I understood that they were part of a single constellation that would make up the book. But even in sort of the micro processes of writing those essays, it was completely different than anything I'd ever written. I really entered into the narrative through language and image and rhythm and sound, and I did not know what the story would be until I was pretty far into it. And that's basically an inversion of the way that I had written most of the previous essays that I'd written, which began with sort of a narrative arc and an outline, and then the images and sound of it came later. And so for that reason, I wrote a lot of it much blinder than I'm used to being, and that was both exhilarating and completely terrifying. You know, we're obsessed with certainty. I know I am, and I knew very little as I was writing, and very much had to sort of discover my content as it was coming out of me.
So interesting. That's there's like 1,000 threads that came out of that I'm now thinking about. But one of them is when you knew this book was going to be much scarier than Whip Smart. And if that is a mining of kind of your subconscious mind, where your body is telling you, okay, I gotta tell the story, and it's kind of even scarier than the story I told before. And mm-hmm. when you know you've gone deep enough, when you know you're being brave enough, when you know you've gotten close enough to the bone, because I think that's really hard for writers, that a lot of them have a natural stopping point where they're like, I'm not going to share that. And you go there every time.
I know. I like, for better or worse, I'm not sure I have that stopping point.
I just go straight
to the bone. Or, I mean, I guess not always straight. So, I mean, you know, I never had that thought. But before, at the outset of the process, I never thought, okay, I'm going to write this book, and it's going to be more intense and more frightening and deeper than the first. Like, if I had had that thought, I'm not sure I would have been able to write the book. And so, in some respect, I wonder if the blindness in which I wrote a lot of the book wasn't my sort of higher creative wisdom or psyche protecting me from that fact so that I could do this necessary thing. And I do think it was necessary. You know, I definitely sort of write to survive, and I don't really mean that very hyperbolically, you know, like I had to tease out answers to certain questions about my own experience. And I often do so that I don't repeat them. And sometimes those repetitions could possibly be life-threatening, certainly with the first book, and with this book, maybe in a more metaphysical way. But, you know, so I sort of groped my way into it. And then there was sort of a series of junctures in the writing where I hit a certain, I don't want to say a wall because it wasn't a wall, but an obstacle. And I thought, oh, shit, like, I'm going to have to go deeper here. I'm going to have to become more honest. I'm going to have to write something that might upset other people. I'm going to have to deconstruct some image of myself that I've been attached to. And a lot of times that moment came after I had shown some of the work to one of my readers, you know, and like many writers, I have a small stable of very smart readers who know me very well and can identify when I'm hiding in my work or when I'm trying to avoid some piece of the truth that makes me particularly uncomfortable. And for me, probably the most dramatic of these moments happened with the final essay. The title essay of the book takes up more than half of the book. It's the entire second half. And I wrote a version of that essay that I felt good about. And then I sent it to two people who know me very well in different respects. And both of them came back and said the exact same thing. And they said, this is lovely, but it's not the truth. It's not the whole story. You've edited out some parts that make you uncomfortable and that might make other people uncomfortable. And if you want to do with this what we know you want to do with this, you're going to have to go back and include those pieces, which was, you know, when you get a good note as a writer, and I'm sure some of your listeners understand this, it's this swift moment of simultaneous relief and devastation, right? Where it's just so, it's something that you already knew and that you didn't want to look at, but there's freedom in understanding that you have no choice, right? So I was like, okay, they're right. I know I did that. And then I had to go back and rewrite the whole thing. And there's a feeling when you hit the bone, I don't know, I think I had to develop this ear, but I can feel it, you know? It's like touching a nerve, you know. I know when I've gotten to it, and it's a kind of landing and a provocation at the same time.
I feel like it's almost that moment in therapy. I don't know how many of our listeners have been in therapy, me all my
life.
But, you know, when you spontaneously just start crying, when you don't even kind of know why, you're like,
yeah,
okay, that's it. And, the therapist's face lights up because, you know, yay, we found it.
Yep. Yay, we got it.
That's how it feels in writing, too. Talking
about that experience. Yeah, I was just talking about that experience, the therapy experience with someone else, and it's really kind of a perfect analogy. And there's always, I have a similar feeling inside of myself. Like, I was actually in therapy last week, and I was talking about something, and then it was like one of those cries where the tears just started falling out of my face. Like, there wasn't a big wind up. I wasn't squeezing anything out, or it wasn't gushing. It's just like, it was this very physical response to an emotional provocation. And there's a particular feeling I get both in the writing process and in the therapy process when that happens, where I feel not proud, but there's something really comforting about it, that I'm capable of having an immediate response to something that makes emotional sense. Like that, like I should cry when I touch the bone, you know, like it should ring like a bell in my mind when that happens. And that hasn't always been so. I think I've worked for it. You know, I think I've sought that out in very painful processes, and having arrived there is proof that I have some access, both to my own emotional range and to a kind of presence with what happens between me and other people, which is mostly what I write about.
Yeah, and I almost feel like it's a proof of authenticity. You know, it's a proof that you got to the authentic part of yourself, that you're not BSing your reader anymore. This is really it.
Yeah.
It's great.
That's the feeling, like, oh, it's real.
Yeah.
I'm telling the truth right now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. I was also wondering about writing too close in proximate time to the actual occurrence of events in your life versus, you know, like, do you need distance? Because some of these things happened in the fairly recent past. I mean, certainly since we talked last time. And sometimes it's hard to process things as they're happening to you. And I was wondering if the sections of the book that, you know, happened long ago were easier or more difficult to write than the sections that you had to, you know, kind of emotionally process while you're writing about it.
Right. I mean, yes and no. I think the childhood parts have been gestating, or my my understanding of them has been developing my whole life, and I don't think I could have written those parts about my family or my parents or my early sense of self and behavior as a child. I don't think I could have written those a moment sooner than I did. And those are the more processed parts. And then, you know, the relationship narrative in this book, which is braided in with all of those childhood parts, you know, it's tricky for me because I'm often in a race against my own memory. I don't have a great memory. I have a very sort of circular, impressionistic, emotional memory. I'm terrible with timelines. I remember some things with crystalline accuracy, I think, and other things just completely get swept away. And so it's tricky. If I waited much longer to write about that relationship, I think I would have lost a lot of the immediacy of it, and I wanted it to be immediate. And in fact, I wrote the first, I would say, three quarters of the book while I was still in that relationship. Like, the first seven essays which deal with the relationship were written while I was in it. And in fact, you know, my partner at the time read early versions of those. I wrote them, like, at her house, which is really interesting. And then I had to stop because I didn't have enough information to write the end. You know, I had to sort of stop and live the end and then write it afterwards. And then I had to go back and revise some of the earlier parts with different bits of truth that I couldn't have looked at while I was still inside of it, you know? And I don't necessarily recommend this. It's not, in an abstract way, it's not my ideal, but it just happens to be the way that I had to write this book. And, you know, I think this is something that all writers have to reconcile, that whenever we write a story, what we write will be a perfect record of our memory and our insight at the time of our writing it. That's it. You know, it won't be the story we would have written while it was happening. And as time goes by, the story always changes. So it's always going to be a record of that particular moment in our understanding as a human being and in our memories. So, you know, it takes work, but I accept that. And I think that this book, you know, this book also doesn't end on a note of perfect resolve. You know, it ends sort of at a beginning, you know, like the end of that relationship was the beginning of a whole other process for me. And who knows, maybe I'll write another book about that. I sort of hope not and suspect so. But I don't, you know, I think we all have to sort of figure out when the right time is. And the story that we need to tell, they come knocking, like they let us know, you know, and this story would not go away. So I knew that now was the time to write it.
Isn't that true? I do think that's really interesting that stories tell you, the book tells you what it's going to be more than often you telling it what it's going to be. I think that's true.
Yeah, exactly. One of my favorite quotes about art making is from Michelangelo, and he said it about sculpture, and he said, I saw the angel in the stone, and I carved to set him free. And some, you know, I read that or heard it somewhere like in my 20s, and I've carried it around in my pocket ever since because it speaks so much to my experience, and I find it such a comfort, you know, to remember that I don't have to know everything when I start. And in fact, it's impossible. If I think I know everything when I start, then there's no reason to write it, right? Because writing is a way of thinking and of coming to understanding for me. And so it's important to remember that the work will tell me what it needs to be and even what shape it needs to be in. I just have to start the process.
Exactly right. My guest this morning is Melissa Phoebos. The book is Abandon Me, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. How much, you've brought this up a couple of times about exposing others, and I was wondering how much you worry about that. Is there sort of a point of privacy that you don't cross, or does it kind of quash or threaten the integrity of the work if you, you know, if you don't expose some of the people in your life in order to serve
right.
your work, you know?
Yeah, I think that this is maybe the foremost worry of most people who are writing memoir or personal nonfiction. I get, you know, everybody's terrified of it. And I think a lot of people wait, you know, they wait until, I don't know, the people who they are going to implicate in their stories die, or I don't know, or maybe they never write them. And for me, it's, I don't know, to the chagrin of some a small but notable group of people, I have somehow always had this instinct to let the story win and to let the writer in me win. And I mean, that doesn't mean that I don't have reverence and consciousness about the ways that my version of my story will affect or implicate or hurt other people. I have a very keen sense of that. But I think that it is imperative that I and anyone writing memoir write the whole story first. Write the whole story first and approximate the greatest truth that you can in writing, and then go back and figure out what is superfluous, what is going to hurt people that is not integral to the story, and then you can take those things out. And I've taken out a lot. And, you know, with my first book, it really wasn't a story about other people. It was very much my story. It wasn't about my family. And those people appeared in the story. So, you know, it felt like the right thing to give it to them beforehand, but I didn't solicit feedback. I didn't offer to change things. And partly that's because it didn't implicate their stories any more than it did mine, but also because I'm not sure I would have been capable of doing that. I didn't know how to have that interaction. And with Abandon Me, it was very different because it was very much about my family. And so early on, like during the editorial process, I gave the manuscript to them and I said, I'm interested in your response to this, in what you see as the factual accuracy of this, and what's going to hurt you. I want to know so that I can try to minimize that as much as possible. And I made no promises, but I ended up making a lot of revisions. And I was able to really show up for that interaction with them, which was possibly the most intimate and adult set of interactions in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very intense. And I feel, like my perspective on that question has changed, you know, and I understand something more about where that line is. And it has something to do with, you know, how much of it is my story. Like, is it a record of an event that featured more largely in my life than in the other person's life? And if the reverse is true, if it was a bigger event in their life than it was in my life, then I think I enter into a different kind of realm where I am invading their privacy in a different way. And I don't think there's an abstract rule or law or equation of fairness here. It's more about the equation of how much you want to protect that person and preserve your relationship with them versus the story you want to tell, you know, and no one can decide that for you. You know, you have to sort of figure it out when you're in it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. And there are a lot of, departing from that question, but there are a lot of really wonderful philosophical and spiritual and literary and musical references in this, all these really wonderful influences that tie to your, it's a wonderful balance between kind of, you know, philosophical insights and personal story, personal narrative. And finding that balance, I think, is interesting. And I assume there was a lot of research, or do you just, did you just go to the places where you knew to go?
Right. It was a mix, you know. I didn't plan to include so many other texts in the work, but I think it's a reflection in many ways of the content, which is about trying to gather insight on the way that you're living and on the way that you're becoming a person and how you conceive of that person and make sense of it and accept it and also change it, you know? And the way that I know how to do those things is by going to other people, other thinkers, other writers. Music, you know, has always been an enormous part of my life. And you know, so a lot of it, I would say probably a majority of the texts and other sources that I bring into the book are things that they've been my companions for a really long time. You know, I bring in a lot of my favorite psychologists and poets and the stories of my childhood. And then some other parts of it came as I was sort of burrowing into these questions about legacy and ancestry and also psychology and relationships. And then I had to find more answers, and I did do some research, and some of that worked its way into the book too. But it felt like you know, writing always feels like a conversation I'm having with myself. And so often I bring these other voices into that conversation. And I think even as a very young person, it felt safer to ask the hard questions to the writers and thinkers that I trusted. One, because they wouldn't judge me or even respond. I could just seek out the responses I needed, you know? But also because I didn't have those answers, you know, and there's such a profound comfort in finding those people who have asked the same questions, like long before my life even began, you know, that sense that I'm not alone, that these are very human questions.
Right. You could put this book to a mixtape. You know, Anthony Mara, who wrote Czar of Love and Techno, like the book was set to a tape.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. I was like, mm-hmm. I could totally mm-hmm. see this being put to a mixtape.
Yeah, in many ways, I think I did. I almost always write to music, and I'll make a playlist for. There was a playlist for every single essay in the book that was just became sort of it sort of nailed the emotional tenor that I found in myself, and then it became sort of like a shortcut. I would play a certain set of songs, sometimes just one song over and over, and that would help me sort of stay on key. If that makes sense.
It does. It does. God, I could talk to you for like 5 hours, but we're drawing down on our time. But
I know.
I wanted to bring up, there was a great essay that you wrote in Granta on teaching after Trump. And not that I stalk you, but I do.
Stalk me.
Here and there on Facebook.
Stalk me.
But I'd love for you to talk a little about the kind of the role of artist, the role of teacher in this current political environment. If you feel like your role is changing with, you know, what's going on in the outside world, or if you kind of stay the course, or how much you let it influence you.
Right. I mean, you know, teaching and writing have always felt like activism to me. And in that sense, my role in those things has not changed, but I have experienced an increased urgency in them and a desire and need to be more explicit in my activism and my focus in those ways, you know? So I think that the role of teaching, the role of narrative, the role of personal narrative are so important in this world that we're living in at this moment. And I'm not writing about different things or teaching different things, but I am focused. I'm more willing to be straightforward both with my students and myself about why it's important, you know, and the questions that we have to ask and the ways that we have to open ourselves to the stories of other people and to the words of thinkers and writers who have something to say about compassion and empathy and action and resistance.
Yep, yep. Is your decision always against fiction? Do you think you'll always be a memoirist and an essayist, or will you dip your toe into the sea of fiction?
You know, I think that I'll always be an essayist and a memoirist, but I don't think that precludes writing fiction. You know, I started writing fiction. Fiction is the great love of my reading life. Like, novels are my first and best love as a reader. And right after Whip Smart was published, I drafted a novel that I returned to a couple of years ago and found that I still loved her. And so I don't know. I don't know if I'll return to that novel again and that will become a thing in the world, but I suspect that I will write fiction again, although it's, you know, I'm definitely married. I'm married to the essay and to memoir.
Yeah. Well, hurry and write, and I'll have you back on. Any last minute words of advice before we go?
I mean, I would just say your listeners are writers mostly, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I would just say, be brave. Like, just don't, you know, there is no worse time wasted as a writer than the time wasted thinking about if you deserve to tell a certain story or not. Just do it. If it's in you to write, then there's someone out there who needs to read it.
I love it. And you do that every time. You're the best teacher of how to be brave and do what you do. Yeah, you are. Melissa Phoebus,
thank you so much.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a very short break. Oh, the book is Abandon Me. It is published by Bloomsbury. It is out and available now. It is wonderful. That is Melissa Phoebos. Can't wait to have her back on again as soon as she writes something new to talk to her more. We're going to take a very short break. Please stay with me. Kate Dolan Leach will be with me for the second half. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUZI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. If you visit us in the next day or two, we're doing a little bit of web maintenance, so just bear with us, but we'll be back up online soon. You can visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. There are direct downloads as well as information on past shows. Almost, I don't know, 18 or 19 years of shows are up there, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. Of course, you can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Stitcher. You can follow us all day long, and I hope you do. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Kate Dolan Leach is a writer and literary translator. She was born in the Finger Lakes region and is a graduate of Trinity College in Dublin and the American University in Paris. Dead Letters is her first novel. It is so fun, and it's published by Random House. It's the subject of our chat this morning. Kate, welcome.
Thanks. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be on the radio.
Oh, congratulations. You deserve to be on the radio. This is what a fun novel.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, I'm seeing this all over bookstores. It feels like every bookstore I walk into, this is front and center and a really fun read. So I'm going to let you introduce it, kind of take us into Dead Letters, how you were inspired for the idea and a little bit about these characters, a little bit about Ava and Zelda.
Sure, absolutely. So Dead Letters is the story of a very dysfunctional family living in upstate New York on their collapsing family vineyard. In this family is a pair of twin sisters, one of whom has seemingly escaped her rural background and moved off to Paris and become estranged from her entire family until she gets an email telling her that her twin sister has allegedly burned to death in a barn fire. Obviously, she feels compelled to go home and find out what really happened because she knows her twin sister, and this seems like a little bit of a too convenient scenario. So she arrives home, and within a few hours, she is receiving messages and clues that her sister may not, in fact, really be dead.
Love it.
And the rest of the book kind of goes from there.
I love it. So talk a little bit about your point of entry into the novel. For you as a writer, like, did you conceive of an idea? Was it the characters themselves of Ava and Zelda that set you off? Was it an image? Talk a little bit about, the first initial conception of the book.
Sure. I mean, I sat down and pretty much just wrote the first 10 or 15 pages in a little bit of a blur, not really knowing what I was doing or what I was thinking about. It kind of, I hate to use the word trance because it sounds sort of like mystical artist nonsense, but I just wrote 10 pages and thought, who are these people? And Ava and Zelda's voices were so clear to me, and they were clearly having a very important conversation, and I felt like I just wanted to let them keep talking and decided I would write as long as they were still saying important things to each other, and I thought it might be a short story, and then it was 100 pages, and I thought, okay, it's a long novella, and then then I finished the novel, and I was like, okay, there we go. They had a lot to say.
So did you write the novel kind of from beginning to end and then go back and revise it? Or tell me a little bit about that process of structuring it and figuring out where the story was and kind of when you knew as writer what the story was going to be.
Yeah, I did pretty much write it in consecutive order, start to finish. And I didn't know much other than the ending, which I'll try not to talk about. But as I was writing, I think there was a sort of halfway point, and it's around the same time Ava figures some of these things out, the alphabetical nature of the clues. And I thought, well, isn't that peculiar? Things seem to be structured like the alphabet. And at that moment, I realized, okay, so we're moving through clues in this sort of consecutive order, and Zelda's in charge. And I kind of just handed over the reins to Zelda and let her drive.
Love it.
And then later went back and sort of polished and tried to figure out the places where it needed, you know, to be tweaked and fixed.
Yeah. I know nothing about, I mean, I'm always amazed at people who can write thrillers and mysteries and, you know, kind of psychologically compelling. So I know this has been compared to Gone Girl and a couple of novels like that. But the advice seems to be that if the writer knows the secret, the reader is going to know the secret, that the writer almost can't help but tip their hand, whether they mean to or not. And the writer needs to be surprised as the reader. I don't know if you found that true to your experience, that you also kind of needed to be surprised by these characters and you know, what was happening between them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Zelda pulled the rug out from underneath me more than a few times. I would think I knew exactly what was happening in a scene, and then I just have this sort of moment of realization. Like, actually, no, she's up to something totally different. And I think sort of manipulating those moments as I revised and remembering the points where I just found myself completely thrown was a lot of the pleasure of revision and sculpting, you know, what would ultimately become the narrative as it is now. And hopefully people have a similar experience of not knowing what's going to happen next.
Absolutely. So talk a little bit about plotting the novel. So you have the novel done, and then your office looks like what? Your process looks like what? Because you've got, you know, 300 pages, however many pages you had at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of keeping all of that straight in your mind, straight in your office. You know, are you really organized in your head, or kind of how did that look?
God, I don't think so. I have a laptop, so I can do everything digitally, and word search is an incredibly useful thing. I remember going through edits with my agent and having to double check all the dates, which got changed a couple of times. So days of the week shifted, and the year that I wrote it in was not a leap year, and the year that it's now set in, I think, is a leap year, or vice versa. I can't remember. Obviously, I'm not that organized in my head. But so there was a lot of this sort of looking at Google calendars and trying to make sure that the restaurant that I'd sent them to on a Wednesday was, in fact, open till 10 p.m. on a Wednesday, and a lot of this stuff that I'm not naturally very good at that took up a lot of the revision time.
Yeah, right. So this might be a good time to talk about, I read this great essay that you, or an interview that you did talking about, and I'm going to totally mispronounce it, but it's called like Oulipo, O-U-L-I-P-O.
Oulipo, yeah.
Oulipo. I don't speak French.
It's fine.
Go ahead.
Sorry, was there a real question? I was just going to jump in and start an electron Oulipo, but that would be very dull.
You go.
So the Oulipo is the ouvrage potentiel de littérature, and it's just a French movement that experiments with the constraints of writing, and they sort of believe that the more constrained your writing is, the more creative you're able to be.
Yeah,
a very brief nutshell.
Yeah, no, I love this idea, and I think there's a lot of wisdom to be mined in this. So the idea is that I think there was a book called, what was it, like Selected Story. It was the story that was told 99 times, same story told 99 times in Exercises in Style.
Yep.
And I think this is a really useful tool for writers to put conscious restraints around their narrative, around their style, around their language in order to enhance their creativity. And maybe you can talk a little bit about how that played out in this book, how you use that tool in order to create this.
Absolutely. I think I talk about it a little bit in the essay, but it was a much more, I realized after the fact how much I had restricted my writing and how Oulipian ideals of constrained writing had informed my process. I knew that I wanted to write in a genre, and genre itself sort of restricts what you're allowed to do. I knew that I wanted to write a book that was fast-paced, that was a little bit of a thriller, that shared a lot of those characteristics. And without realizing, I think, maybe what that would mean, what I was allowed to do and what I wouldn't be allowed to do. And in a way that sort of, it narrows your choices down so that things actually become a little bit more manageable, when you're writing a novel, you can do anything. You can literally create entire new worlds. But if you're writing a thriller, you have to have it set in a world that pretty closely resembles the one we live in, and it has to not have unnecessary descriptive passages, and there needs to be sort of a sense of cliffhangers at certain moments. So in a way, I found that not being able to do whatever I wanted let me focus on the story I was actually writing.
Right, right. I think there's great power in that. And I think, you know, I mean, novels, especially for first-time novelists, can feel very overwhelming. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, and so to put natural restraints on yourself, I think, is actually a wonderful, wonderful idea. I came across these cards, and now I can't remember the name of them, but it's a deck of cards that is meant to kind of be creative prompts. But really what it does is kind of rein you in, you know, that your character needs to act in a certain way or that your character
Absolutely.
Needs to make a certain discovery. And I think that's, especially for first-time novelists, kind of a great way to wrap your mind around, you know, how to produce a 400-page work.
and just to practice a little bit and see what it feels like if you're not, you know, if you can't set it on a faraway planet set 400 years from now, when in fact you have to set it in 1930s noir fiction territory, and all of your female characters have to be secretaries, you know, you have to write something different. So I think it can be a fun experiment, and I found it to be more than an experiment. I found it to be my first novel.
Right. Talk a little bit about writing prickly characters, because as you said, you know, the family is so dysfunctional. You know, they're not entirely lovable people.
They are not. In fact, a lot of people find them completely unpalatable and can't spend 350 pages with them, which I think is a totally fair thing because they are genuinely miserable. And I think each character is completely unlikable. I don't think there's anyone in the book who doesn't have this side of them that is a little bit skin crawling. I'm not sure that I intended to make them that way. It seemed very natural to have these very flawed characters. I found that I didn't really want to spend a lot of time with nice or friendly or easy characters. It was just much more interesting to have someone who had deep psychological issues and trauma. And the story is very much about how family trauma gets passed on and how the stories that we tell about our family members turn them into these sort of self-created monsters that you know, the way that you think about your sister actually turns her into the sort of crazy person that you think she is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I just ended up doubling down on that.
Who gave you the most difficulty? Who was the most difficult to mine, to understand, to, you know, give some sort of empathy to, and kind of how did you deal with them?
I think there's a tie between Marlon and Nadine. Nadine, because she's not fully present, you know, because she's suffering from dementia, she's not really all there. So it's hard to get a window into her because she's just, She's moving back into moments of her childhood, and she's confusing who she is and who her children are. So she's not even really herself, and that can be very difficult to get a handle on. And similarly, Marlon is just, he's an escape artist. He spends his whole life just trying to get away from you. So I would find myself trying to pin him down on the page, and every single time he would come up with an excuse to leave the house.
Right.
And I would just be sitting there being like, well, God damn it, Marlon! You have to give us a little glimpse. So they were both very absent parents and absent characters that I struggled to tease out.
How much do you feel like you know about them that didn't make it onto the page? Like how much? Do you keep kind of notes about them someplace, or little? I hear of writers keeping kind of scrapbooks or things that you feel like secrets you knew about them that that never made it into the novel.
I definitely feel like I know a little bit about both of their childhoods. I've got some ideas about how they both grew up and what happened in their family households. We get a little bit more of Nadine's backstory directly on the page. But I think Marlon also has a very weird childhood, moving around a lot, sort of in the Deep South. And I think it's fun to imagine the sort of prequels when you're writing, to think of what their dysfunctional family narrative might have been. And that was important for me to have at least hovering as I wrote them.
I love that. I love that. My guest this morning is Kate Dolan Leach. The book is Dead Letters. It's published by Random House, and such a fun read. So talk about, I know you were a translator, and you obviously speak gorgeous French. I could just listen to you speak French all day long. But talk a little bit about how that might influence your, if at all, it might influence your fiction, and how much of your translation work, which is itself, you know, a very constraining, talk about putting constraints on work.
Exactly.
A very constraining activity.
So they're, I shouldn't say radically different activities because they're both literary activities, but they're emotionally and technically very different. Mm-hmm. When you're translating, I mean, you're working with someone else's text and you have responsibility to the person who created it. So there's this anxiety that you're getting things wrong all the time, that you're making the wrong choices, that you're giving up things that the author themselves would hate to see go. And there's this very particular kind of stress that comes from just not being the author, not being the one who's calling the shots, but who is nevertheless responsible for producing a final text that will be a lot of people's only relationship to the original. And then when you're writing, you don't have any of that. You get to make every single choice. You can literally do whatever you want. And I think, especially writing some of the Zelda passages, for me, it was exhilarating not to have to choose anything, to put in as many words as I wanted and to let her ramble and to use way too many adverbs and just kind of not make choices. That freedom felt really very liberating. Mm-hmm. But it can also, I think, as we touched on, be a little overwhelming. So having a text that you start with when you translate, it's in a way comforting because you sort of know what you're getting into to some extent when you sit down to translate a book. You know how long it's going to be. You know what sort of words you'll probably need to use. And you have an idea of how long it'll probably take you. So there are trade-offs, I think, with both.
Do you think living in France and, you know, obviously Ava had escaped to France, the book doesn't take place there, but I don't know how much that informed or, and growing up where you grew up, how much setting is infused with, you know, with your own experiences and how hard it was to bring kind of the setting and the background into life?
Yeah, so I grew up in the Finger Lakes where the book is set and then moved away when I was 17 and have spent much of the last 12 years coming and going from Ithaca, which is a sort of ironic place to spend your life voyaging to and from. and that sort of emotional experience of going home to a small town, to a rural place, is something that I've heard a lot of people discuss and talk about as this really intense and very particular feeling of having felt like you got out, in a sense, and you're out seeing the world, and then you have to go home. And that I knew that I wanted the first scene to be in that in-between space on an airplane with Ava just sort of considering what it means to be returning home again. Mm-hmm. And how that, how she will have to change versions of herself to accommodate that.
Yeah, I love all of that, those issues of identity and who you become around who you are and, you know, the context.
And how it changes with your geography. I mean, it's this bizarre thing.
Yeah, right.
And throw in another language and you're set up for a solid schizophrenic break.
Right. Yeah, I love this. And, you know, the dialogue in here was so wonderful. And finding these characters' voices, I don't know how naturally dialogue comes to you. It comes very unnaturally to me. So I always marvel when it sounds right, when characters sound distinct and, you know, when writers get it just right. Can you talk a little bit about that, whether you read these passages out loud to make the dialogue sound authentic, to make the character sound distinct?
Yeah, I think I do sometimes read aloud, but I really like writing dialogue. It feels like a very fertile place to explore who the characters actually are because they actually get to speak for themselves. So I find I actually write a lot more dialogue scenes that don't necessarily make it into final drafts. because you just learn a little bit about the characters when they're in conversation with each other, rather than trying to guess at what's going on with their internal monologue or just watching them move around sort of on the page. So it's how I explore, I guess, a character, to just have them talk to someone else and see what they say.
I just have them stand at a window and gaze out for hours at a time.
Like, maybe they've just woken up from a nap.
Right. They're always right. So now with one novel under your belt, what do you feel like? Do you feel like this novel taught you something, taught you about approaching the second novel, how you would do things the same or differently, and, you know, kind of what you learned through the process?
I hope it has taught me some things. It's, you know, I go back and forth between thinking my next book will very much be an extension of this book and thinking that it's totally different. So that anxiety, I think, is fruitful, but also anxious. And my experience is that every writing project is a little bit different. So while I might be able to borrow some of the things that I've learned about plotting from Dead Letters, I think the next book I'm just going to have to wing it, much like I have to wing everything you sit down to write is kind of a big question mark until
right.
It's not.
Right. So frustrating. Yeah, it's...
It can be, yeah. I mean, it can be very exciting, but it's also alarming.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I've talked to a lot of writers who feel like, oh, I poured kind of all my greatest ideas, my greatest character thoughts, my, you know, whatever into this book. And what comes next? And, you know, something always comes next. Something always bubbles up from the subconscious. But it is kind of a paralyzing feeling of, oh, my God, I gave this my best material. And where do I go?
And they have that, there's that saying, you know, don't save anything for the next book, which I've always taken to heart. But then you finish the book and you say, I didn't save anything for the next book.
What now?
So you have to start all over and... Hope that there's more there.
Yeah, indeed. Well, this is fantastic. We are drawing down on our time, but I'd love for you to leave us with, I guess that is some writing advice, but anything that's come out of either this process or things that you've heard from other writers that it kind of sustained you during this process, writing advice for writers?
I think there are two things for me that I learned and that were very uncomfortable lessons. And the first one is to let anyone and everyone read your stuff. If you're planning on letting it get published and putting it out in the world, you can't say no. If someone asks to read it, you let them read it and you ask them for their opinion. And then the other one is to not be afraid to throw stuff out. You know, I wrote another novel before this that was not great. And it was sad to chuck it out the window, but I had to do it. And, you know, that's life.
Yeah. That is one of the most painful lessons, I think, for writers is to, you know, is to be able to let go. And you know how much it took.
Delete scenes, even if you thought they were amazing. And if someone hates it, you say, okay, well, maybe that was that.
Yeah. And you have to tell yourself that nothing is really lost, you know, that through the act of having written that scene, something in you was gained, right? Or else it's too hard to...
Right. You can always revisit it somehow, or you got that, you know, it's a way of getting the emotional truth out of the way.
Yeah.
You know, I think of the first novel that I wrote as something I had to do to just sort of clear my palate and create space,
exactly.
Sort of create psychic space for the next project. And it doesn't feel good, but... I think necessary.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. Kate Dolan Leach, this was such a pleasure. Congratulations. This is wonderful.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on. I love this podcast.
Oh.
I've been subscribing, and it's fabulous, so
thanks.
I'll keep listening.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much. That was Kate Dolan Leach. The book is Dead Letters. It's out and available now, published by Random House. That is all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9, so stay with us for that. And stay tuned. Drea Gonzalez will be here with some Latin beats to keep your Wednesday morning going. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.